Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path, and I'm your host, Mike Allen. Where was the very first law school in the entire United States? Well, that honor belongs to the Litchfield Law School in the town of Litchfield, the county of Litchfield, but it's also known as the Tapping Reeve Law School, after its founder, attorney Tapping Reeve. You know, it had an outsized impact on the United States because the very first lawyers trained in the new Constitution passed through its doors. Well, here to tell us about it today is Kathy Fields. We're lucky to get her. She's the outgoing, retiring director of the Litchfield Historical Society, and she's got some great stories to share about how the law school impacted the U.S. and the town of Litchfield. This week's trivia question: if you were having dinner in France and the conversation at the dinner table centered on your ancestors' help in winning U.S. independence in the 1700s, whose family house would you be in? Well, stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. Yale New Haven Hospital was the very first hospital in Connecticut. They opened their doors 200 years ago and later introduced the entire country to the use of penicillin and chemotherapy. Today, some of the brightest minds in medicine choose to work there, and it's the primary teaching hospital for the prestigious Yale School of Medicine. For more information, log on to ynhhs.org. That's ynhhs.org. Well, as we all know, Connecticut's got a very long history because it was one of the very first of the original 13 colonies when European immigrants came to these shores. We had the first prison, the first dictionary, the first library, and so on and so forth. The list does go on. Well, add another one to the pile. It was the state with the first law school in the country. The question of where that first law school was actually situated has stumped many a person because it's in out-of-the-way Litchfield. Yet, for an unlikely location like Litchfield, the Litchfield Law School, started by attorney Tapping Reeve and continued by his partner James Gould after Reeve retired, the influence they had was really very remarkable. The school put its mark on the young United States in a number of different ways, and we're lucky to have our guest today, Kathy Fields, here to tell us all about it. Lucky because we caught up with her just as she was departing her position as director of the Litchfield Historical Society and starting a well-deserved retirement. Kathy, I think it's incredible that Connecticut can boast the first law school in the country. And when I first heard that piece of trivia, I thought, oh yeah, it must have been Yale. And then I come to find out, no, it was in Litchfield. It was called the Litchfield Law School. That's just incredible.
It is. It's an amazing story. I almost didn't believe it when I came here for my interview for the job. I'm a believer now. It's an amazing story and a really great contribution to American history that happened in little tiny Litchfield.
Now, of course, in 1784, there were lawyers and they were educated and competent in the law, but the way they learned it was through apprenticeship, right?
Right. So American lawyers up to that point, and really they were colonial lawyers, learned law in the traditional English way, which was called reading law. So you apprenticed with a lawyer for a number of years in a lawyer's chambers or a lawyer's office, and that lawyer gave you work to do or taught you things. And essentially, your legal education was as good as the lawyer who you apprenticed with. Sometimes it was a great education, and sometimes it was hard to learn anything. There was no continuity in the way it was run.
Now, along comes this guy named Tapping Reeve, and we'll get into the history of him himself a little bit later. But he comes along and says, I'm going to change all this and turn it on its head by taking some of the people who are apprenticing in my office, and at that point it had gotten to be quite a few, and I'm going to actually conduct some lectures. So tell me how that all happened.
It's hard to know how it actually happened, but Tapping Reeve was initially trained as a teacher, and that was the career that he thought he was going to follow. And I think he probably was a good teacher. He eventually studied law. He read law with a lawyer in Hartford. His name was Jesse Root. And then he started a practice of law and, as you said, had students coming to him to apprentice. He started that in 1774. And somewhere between 1774 and 1784, he morphed into the lecture series. I think it was a gradual thing. I think he was a natural born teacher. And because he had teacher training and he loved teaching, he just developed this system from the apprenticeship system.
And what it basically boiled down to, if I have my facts straight, is about a 14-month-long course that followed the Blackstone commentaries?
He started with Blackstone, which was English law, because we hadn't fought or won the revolution at that point. So he was teaching them English common law, and that was from Blackstone. But then once the revolution and the Constitution happened, he started teaching the laws of the United States as they developed. The course changed continuously because he was teaching American law as it happened.
Now let's get into a little bit of Tapping's background here, because I think this is fascinating, and of course a big prominent name will come up in this, in fact two of them. He's born in 1744. He's born on Long Island. His dad went to Yale. He himself graduated from Princeton, at that point called the College of New Jersey. And while he's there, he gets tapped to privately teach the children of Reverend Aaron Burr Sr. And who are those children?
Well, those children are Aaron Burr, who we know from his connection with Alexander Hamilton, among other things, and Sally Burr, who was Aaron Burr's younger sister. That's part of he trained to be a teacher. His first real job was teaching these young men and a young woman. And then over the course of time, he and Sally fell in love. Sally was not yet 18. Both Aaron and Sally were orphaned at this point. They wanted to marry, and they appealed to her guardian, who was Timothy Edwards Burr. And he said no, that Sally was too young. So at that point, that's the point that Reeve came up to Hartford and studied law with Jesse Root. And we don't know why, but I think it's possible that law was a profession that was more acceptable to the Burr family, who were a slightly higher social echelon than Reeve. So he studied law, he passed the bar, was ready to set up a practice, and by that time, Sally had turned 18 or 19, they appealed to Uncle Timothy again, and he said sure. So they got married, and it was quite a love match, and they were very happy.
So now the couple moves to Litchfield, and he establishes a practice in Litchfield, and this is where he's taking on students as apprentices first, and then slowly starts to, as you say, morph into this other situation of lecturing. Now, the question is, this is obviously, as he's setting up his practice in, I think, 1772, this is right before the Revolution breaks out, and it's during the Revolutionary War period that all this morphs. So what's the overlap there?
We don't have Tapping Reeve's papers. I hope they're in an attic someday and will turn up. So we sort of have to put the pieces together. His first student that came to read law with him was Aaron Burr. Burr stayed from 1775 approximately until the war really started, and then he left. But other students kept coming. And it was just in the same time period as the Revolution that the students were coming, and some of them left, obviously, to participate in the war, and many stayed and became the first crop of lawyers in the new country. As people came and studied with him, his reputation grew, and it was a lot of word of mouth.
So here's a guy who starts off as a teacher, ends up learning law, turns the world upside down on its head, at least in the colonies, by suddenly now teaching through lectures. And by 1798, not that much later, he's actually elected to the Connecticut Supreme Court, if I have that part right, or appointed or elected. But either way, he became Chief Justice of the Connecticut State Supreme Court. That's amazing.
Yeah, he must have been an amazing guy. He was well-loved. He was well-respected. He had been offered a judgeship several times before he actually accepted it. And he didn't accept it, I think, at first because Sally was something of an invalid. We don't know exactly what was wrong with her, but she was quite sickly. And he did not accept the judgeship till after she passed away. So I think he was really devoted to her and to the school at that point. And then once she was gone, I think he felt it was easier to be on the road a little bit. And judges in those days rode a circuit. It wasn't that the courthouse was in one place, but they traveled around the state. so it meant more travel for him. And actually, that's the point when he took a partner in the law school whose name was James Gould, and Gould had been one of his students. So from that point on, there were actually two teachers in the school.
And just so people get the right idea here, this wasn't just a few guys who were in his office who he was lecturing to. By 1813, he had 55 students. And this is at a point when there were only 100 practicing attorneys in the entire state of Connecticut. And he would eventually teach and would go through this school over 49, 50 years, 1,000 different students from all over the country.
I think we've identified just over 1,000 students, and we keep finding them. But they did. They came from, at the beginning, 13 states and territories. They were coming from all over the country and a little bit from out of the country. We've been trying to follow their careers and see what kind of mark they made on the country. I call it the partridge in a pear tree list. We had two vice presidents, over 100 United States congressmen, 28 senators, 6 cabinet members, 3 justices of the United States Supreme Court, 14 governors, and I think 13 chief justices of state Supreme Courts, and that's just the higher offices. They really had their hands in everything that happened. We determined that about 10% of the United States Congress in 1800 had attended the school, which basically meant that anything that happened in Congress between 1800 and 1850, and that was a lot, these guys had their hands in one way or the other. So they really were instrumental in the way this country shaped. They were the sons and grandsons of the men who fought the Revolution and wrote the Constitution. And these guys took it as sort of a personal responsibility to make the Constitution work. It was an untried document. Nobody really knew what was going to happen. These guys are on extreme ends of both political parties at the time, but they had this sense of responsibility that it was their duty to make this document work, and that's what they did.
So if the sad part has to be told, it was 1833, I guess, when the Litchfield Law School finally closed its doors when Gould himself, the second professor, ended up retiring after Reeve had already retired. I guess this was a series of reasons why, but names like Yale and Harvard and Columbia had popped up and were offering their own schools. Was it just impossible to compete in that kind of scenario?
Well, yes. And really, by that time, as you said, the universities had established law schools, and it really made more sense to have a law school associated with a university than sort of up here in the middle of nowhere or a proprietary school like this was. It just was made financial sense. It made sense in the way you could attract students. And they were popping up all over the country, so that the sort of draw of students from all over the country had lessened, because if you didn't have to travel, you know, travel was time consuming and dangerous and expensive. If you didn't have to travel from Ohio to go to law school in Connecticut, if you could do something closer, you would. It just was impossible to keep it going. And it was also very much tied to the personalities of Reeve and Gould. And when you get into the university law schools, they're not tied to one personality like that.
Now, these were golden years for Litchfield, because not only did it have the first law school in the country, but it was also hosting a famous girls' school nearby. Could you talk about that?
Sure. When you put the two schools together, Litchfield turns into a really interesting place. The girls' school was called the Litchfield Female Academy, or Sarah Pierce's school. And Sarah Pierce was the founder of that school, and it started in 1792, so a little bit later than the law school. Pierce was a really, really interesting woman. She trained as a teacher in New York and got what was traditional teacher training for women, which really was a little bit of math and reading and a little bit of writing and lots of sewing and singing and domestic arts. But Sarah Pierce had the idea that women actually had brains and that they could be taught the same curriculum as men. So she sent her nephew to Williams College up in Massachusetts, where he graduated with her. And he brought back the stuff that he learned at Williams. So he was able to teach higher mathematics and sciences and philosophy and languages and geology and botany and just wonderful stuff that she didn't have the advantage of being able to learn in the way women did. So the school was incredibly well attended. We've identified just over 1,000 law students. We've identified, I think, close to 2,000 female academy students. And we think there were probably 3,000 over the course of the school, which also closed in the 1830s. And these women, they were as young as 11, 12 years old, and some of them were in their 20s. But it really was the highest level of education that was available to women at the time. It was groundbreaking and set the standard for other girls' schools that came after it. So in Litchfield, we had all these young men at the law school and all these young women at the female academy. And so we've now identified over 100 marriages between students at the two schools. And those are just the students themselves. It was a small world then. So if you think about, you know, neighbors and cousins and nephews and, you know, friends, this was a way to really to meet people and to socialize that really wasn't available in any other small town in this country, maybe in a big city, but not in a town.
I know that the students at the law school had to stay with local families because there was no room and board. Was that the same thing at the Pierce School?
Yes, it's called the family boarding system. Both law students and female academy students roomed and boarded around town. And in many cases, they were in the same houses. We have the rules of the school that the female academy students had to write out and sign. And the rules of the school had a lot to do with following the rules of their family. And so their life was a little bit more closely watched than the law students who didn't have those same strictures. But we do have letters from female academy students who complain about being sort of relegated up to the attic in not great bedrooms. Well, the law students got the best rooms on the second floor because their education was more important. But they did live in the same houses, and they knew each other. There were lots of parties and social events between the two schools. The writings of the students really indicate this very, very active social life. And sometimes it seems to me it was like they're living in a Jane Austen novel. It's the same time period, and there's misunderstandings and jiltings and broken engagements and all the stuff that happens in Jane Austen. And they were actually living that here in Litchfield. So it's a really fascinating story.
That wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. The Tapping Reeve Law School in Litchfield, opened in Tapping Reeve's house, is now a museum in Litchfield, and it's on the National Register of Historic Places. Well worth a visit to check it out. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Kathy Fields, the outgoing director of the Litchfield Historical Society, and we wish her well in her retirement. The answer to this week's trivia question: if you were having dinner in France and the conversation at the dinner table centered on your ancestors' help in winning U.S. independence way back in the 1700s, whose home would you be in? Well, the answer in this particular case is the Rochambeau family, and our very special guest for next week's episode, in fact the 100th episode of Amazing Tales CT, will be none other than Raphael de Gouberville. He is the, count this, great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson of Rochambeau himself. Yes, that's seven greats. Wait until you hear his take on the war for independence here in the U.S. from the French perspective. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.